Hi, I'm Dean Koontz. Welcome to my podcast. For many years, I used lines of verse as epigraphs in the front of novels or at part divisions of novels from a book called The Book of Counted Sorrows. And over the years, the more I used excerpts from it, the more letters we got about it, until we were eventually getting 3,000 letters a year from people who wanted The Book of Counted Sorrows and couldn't find it. And we got letters from librarians who said, "I have spent 30 hours searching for the Book of Counted Sorrows for patrons, and I can't find it." And it was interesting. Every librarian would have to start her letter or his letter by telling me precisely how many hours were spent searching for it. I spent 20 hours. I spent 32. And of course, nobody ever found it because the book didn't exist. It was an apocryphal book. I made it up, and I wrote the verses that I quoted from it. I never imagined anybody would be interested in the book or anybody would not realize what I was doing. I was a little fearful of librarians after that because I was afraid the moment I revealed it, they were going to be on my doorstep. But I ultimately did reveal it, and people have been asking for years for the publication of The Book of Counted Sorrows. It was published as a limited, signed and numbered collector's edition by Charnel House, which published 1,250 copies at $100 each. That's too expensive for a lot of people. And now that book is sold out and sells on the collector's market for $1,000 to $2,000. That's even more expensive. So what we have done on the deankoontz.com website is we have published our own edition of The Book of Counted Sorrows. And you can buy it only from the website. Or at the website, you can get a phone number that you can call and do it over the phone. I hope you're going to enjoy having the book Counted Sorrows. It's all the verses that I ever quoted, plus some that I didn't quote. I don't know why people want these. I'm not a poet. But if they want them, there they are. But because I wasn't a poet and I didn't want to write a great many verses to pad out the book, I did write a 20-some thousand word introduction that will give you the history of the book of Counted Sorrows. I'm going to read two parts. This is the first you're listening to now, from the Book of Counted Sorrows. They will be chapter 5, and I'll begin with the first part of chapter 5. This comes later in the history of the book, and this is about what happened to an actor named Langford Crispin, who owned the book for a portion of time. Now, it's sad to say that everybody who reads the Book of Counted Sorrows comes to a grievous end. Many of them, their heads explode. We think that's because the wisdom in these verses is so enormous that once you get it all in your head, there's not enough room in there for everything, and your skull begins to swell to try to make room for it, except it swells to a mortal degree. And other terrible things happen to people. Sometimes not just the skull explodes, but the entire body. Now, when you buy the book, if you do it at our website, you're protected because we've removed two of the poems from the book and give you only their titles, so you'll never be able to read those two, and you will never suffer the fate of people like Langford Crispin. So here is chapter 5, which is titled The Hideous Fate of Langford Crispin. The first recorded owner of the Book of Counted Sorrows was Langford Crispin, the immortal film star. Born Nate Furt, the only child of Sepsis and Donna Furt of Cheese Falls, Wisconsin, he went on the vaudeville circuit at 16, tap dancing while singing and simultaneously juggling flaming snakes in blackface. Certain unnamed associates of the legendary performer Al Jolson, who did not himself juggle snakes, flaming or otherwise, but who did frequently appear in blackface, which is surely no less bizarre to our modern sensibilities, waylaid poor Nate in an alley behind a theater in Cleveland. These showbiz rowdies terrified him with much aggressive finger wagging, rude use of the word jam, the verb form, not the noun, and with dire threats to tell his saintly mother, back in Cheese Falls, that while on the road he had become a sissy boy who wore women's clothes and conducted an immoral romantic relationship with the woolly half of Laura Lunny's famous act, Laura Lunny and His Singing Llama. This was, of course, a filthy lie, but Nate never again performed in blackface, partly to make himself less visible to Jolson's ruthless associates, and also as a consequence of a related realization that Nate Furt was not an ideal name for a would-be vaudeville star. He legally changed his name to Bob Furt, later to Bert Furt, later still to Melbourne Furt, then to Foghorn Leghorn, subsequently to Yosemite Sam, then only briefly and in desperation over his floundering career to Al Jolson, and finally to Langford Crispin. Although a miserable failure in vaudeville, Langford Crispin was a huge and immediate hit in films, which was a new and exciting art form then, and not one that had yet been taken over by the dreaded stupid mafia, a criminal conspiracy of the intellectually challenged, which eventually seized control of the movie business by the late 1960s. Langford was nominated for an Academy Award in 1930 for All Quiet on the Western Front. If you have seen this classic film, Langford's astonishing portrayal of Lou Ayres' brother, Jinky, will stay with you forever. Jinky, a carefree circus clown, trades in his polka dot jumpsuit for a uniform and his giant floppy shoes for combat boots to go off to Europe and fight for his country and for the dignity of humanity. In the brutal trench warfare against the Germans, on blasted landscapes smoky with mustard gas, Jinky learns to his surprise that war really is hell, and that a unicycle is more difficult to pilot through bomb craters than around Barnum and Bailey's center ring. Nevertheless, through the unremitting horror, he holds fast to his sense of humor, and even as he is dying, he manages to squeeze the hand pump bulb that operates the squirting flower in the lapel of his torn battle jacket, thoroughly wetting the startled face of the medic who is trying without success to staunch his wounds. Langford was again nominated for Best Actor for his role in Cimarron, 1931, the epic adaptation of Edna Ferber's novel, in which he starred with Richard Dix and the lovely Irene Dunne. In this tale of a pioneer family determined to build an empire in early Oklahoma, Langford played Richard Dix's gentle brother, Soupy, who wants only to spread Christian fellowship and a proper appreciation of flower arrangement to the crude communities of the primitive prairie. His sweetness and innocence are ultimately met with mockery, gunfire, and a blazing wagon loaded with dynamite. Langford was first seen reading the Book of Counted Sorrows between takes on the set of Cimarron during filming in 1930. By the time he was making Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with the brilliant Frederick March in 1931, he kept the book always within reach and carried it with him wherever he went, when not actually before a camera. If his hands were full of parcels, he carried the book on his head, balanced with the confidence of a man who had begun his vaudeville career juggling flaming snakes. If his hands were full of parcels, and if something was already balanced on his head, such as a basket of bread or a jug of water or a dwarf, his vaudeville friend, Tiny Johnson, shorter than a yardstick, enjoyed the view from this high perch, then Langford carried the precious book in his teeth. If his hands were filled with parcels, and if a water jug or a cheerful dwarf was balanced on his head, and if also he was involved in a conversation, then he carried the book between his knees, which required him to walk funny, and drew stares from strangers. But he was not a man who ever cared what others thought of him. In Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you will remember Langford as Frederick March's half-brother, Jerry Jekyll, who was on the lam pursued by the London Constabulary for roughing up a group of children carolers when they insisted on singing God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen instead of Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree, which he had requested in return for a donation of a shiny halfpence. By the end of the film, Jerry learns all the wrong lessons from the disgrace and death of his arrogant brother. Vowing to achieve a scientific breakthrough even more dazzling than that of the late Dr. Jekyll, Jerry flees to Europe, changing his name to Victor Frankenstein, with the intent to prove that sundry parts of various dead people can, through the miracle of electric shock, be assembled into a presentable new person capable of providing cheap but nevertheless high-quality domestic labor. In 1932, Langford Crispin's performance as Jerry Jekyll brought him the Academy Award for the Best Supporting Actor. He was the first winner ever to thank all the little people. And when he spoke this phrase, which countless winners would use after him, he doffed his enormous top hat to reveal an actual little person, Tiny Johnson, sitting on his head. In our time, this stunt might have been politically incorrect, or at least insensitive and perhaps tasteless to some. In those long ago days, however, the entertainment community wasn't as refined as it has become in this most genteel age of Charlie Sheen, Howard Stern, Eminem, and Freddie the Farting Chimp. With perhaps the exception of Mary Pickford and Francis the Talking Mule, entertainers in those days were largely an unseemly, unrefined, unpolished, uncouth, undolent, unplumbed, unzipped, undone, uncaged, unearthed, unbonneted rabble. When Langford removed his top hat to reveal Tiny Johnson perched on his pate, the crowd at the Academy Awards roared with laughter, howled and stomped their feet, and hooted and spat copiously. Only 16 years later, accepting his Best Actor Oscar for Hamlet, when Laurence Olivier thought it would be great good fun to repeat Langford's stunt, he doffed his top hat, revealed the same Tiny Johnson, and was met by the stunned silence of a disapproving audience, so painfully refined and classy that every last one of them was wearing clean underwear. Olivier stood in utter mortification, his smile as frozen as a banana sickle. When Tiny Johnson lit a sparkler and began to wave it and an American flag, in what must have seemed in the planning to be a stroke of show business genius, the offended audience gasped in shock, drawing in so much air at the same time that ushers standing the aisles came dangerously close to imploding in the brief vacuum. That the Queen of England, even many years later, could overlook the shameless spectacle and bestow a knighthood on Olivier is incontestable proof of the resiliency and the compassion of the British monarchy, or proof, perhaps, of the sadly short memory capacity that has resulted from the inbreeding of all European royalty over the centuries. I am happy to tell you that Langford Crispin, a kind and most considerate man who helped many orphans and deserved no one's scorn, was not humiliated by Olivier's award show performance, because Crispin had by then been dead for many years. I can also assure you that dear Langford was not subjected to the discomfort of having to spin in his grave, because after his emulsified body was scraped off the ceiling of the library in his Beverly Hills mansion, his remains were not in suitable condition to be shaped into a suit for viewing at his funeral, and the several jars of his mortal substance were at once cremated. It is possible, I suppose, that in response to Olivier's capering at the Academy Awards show, Langford's ashes whirled in the urn where they were stored, but that is a far more pleasant image than a decaying carcass tumbling around and around among worms and filth and rotting grave cloth inside a termite-riddled coffin. Where was I? Oh, yes, Langford Crispin. This has been the Dean Koontz Podcast. I'll continue this in part 2. For more information like this, visit my website at deankoontz.com.